Welcome to another episode of the Rain Race Podcast. Today we'll be giving our thoughts on the 12 hours of Sebring, from the handful of yellows to the grandstand finish. We'll also be discussing Chip Ganassi Racing's announced departure from Cadillac and the 2025 IMSA schedule. If you enjoy this episode and you want to join us for the live discussion in the future, you can check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/@GTRain. Again, that's youtube.com/@GTRain. Until next time, enjoy. How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Rain Race Podcast. I'm your host, GT Rain, joined alongside me, as always, the very great Off in the S's. How are you doing on this fine Tuesday evening?
Well, I guess I could say that I'm doing very great on this fine Tuesday evening. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. You know, we're coming off the 12 hours of Sebring. We're coming off a pretty decent news week in the sports car racing world. Got a lot to talk about this episode, so looking forward to going over all of those things with you. The great thing, again, I say this every single episode, it's a live show, so we got a chat box on YouTube. If you want to ask us some questions, you want to yell at me about my opinions that might be coming later in this episode, you can use that as your opportunity to do so. Mentioned just a minute ago that we're coming off the 12 hours of Sebring, second race of the 2024 WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. And Stu, I think I'll let you take the reins here on the on leading us with the Sebring recap.
Oh, you're gonna let me take the reins on the Rain Race Podcast. I like it. I like it. Clever, clever. Yeah. So the 12 hours of Sebring this year. You know, you can't say that Sebring has disappointed us with the levels of excitement the past. I don't think there's ever been a boring 12 hours of Sebring. So what we'll do is we'll run through some of the key events that happened in the race, and then we'll dive into some more of the winners and stuff afterwards. So a couple of notes that we had here, focusing on the very end of the race to start with, is five of the last six 12 hours of Sebring have had a restart in the final 25 minutes. The only exception to that rule was in 2022. Of course, we had we had the iconic wreck. That didn't quite happen. I think that caused the last, think that was the final yellow last year. There was a lot going on at the end of last year's race, much like there was at the end of this year's race. You know, we had some debris cautions there right at the end that really kind of, we thought, you know, you were hopeful maybe that we were going to get an hour run to the finish, and then we got a couple of yellows right there. But ultimately 12 full course yellows overall, which was the same as last year. A war of attrition to a certain extent, but maybe not for the reason that we would have liked. There was a lot of wrecks that took place, some of the notable ones, of course. Everybody's seen the video. If you didn't watch the race live, you've seen the video of the number 31 Action Express Racing Cadillac, Pipo Durrani, going hard into those tires, and a very scary crash there. Landed on, of course, the roof of that car. He walked away after getting some assistance to get out of the car from the AMR safety crew. Another big hit that we also saw that I feel like kind of got overshadowed a little bit with the incidents that happened later in the race. The Tower Motorsports number 8. I can't recall who was in the car at the time, but they had a pretty hard off as well into the barriers. Of course, that was my pick for LMP2. And the final hard hit that we'll touch on here, and I'll turn it over to you in a second for your thoughts on some of this madness, Chris. But the Gradient Racing number 66 Acura, this was one of those late race incidents, was going to go into the pits, made contact with the number 6 Porsche, and Catherine Legg went very hard into the outside tire wall and ricocheted back out into the middle of the track. A hard hit for her in the late stages of this race. But I know that you were I don't know if vocal is the right word, but
we'll take it.
You had some things to say about some of the that's some of the cautions, some of the wrecks that we saw.
Yeah, I definitely do. So let's we'll save that for a minute later. I do want to say, you mentioned race of attrition. You're right, it was sort of a race of attrition, but not usually in the way we would expect. You know, usually you would think engine failures, suspensions getting destroyed by the bumps at Sebring. A lot of it really seemed like it was bodywork related, and there were at least a couple of cautions just related to bodywork being out on the track. The Ford Mustang GT3 car is still suffering some woes to the start of that car's program.
Word is parts were still falling off of it after they were putting it in the truck. No.
Big if true. No. Those were some of the yellows that we had seen. I did want to get your thoughts on the Gradient Racing contact with the number 6 Porsche. At the time, to me, that seemed like it was sort of a slam dunk penalty to the number 6 car. Of course, they didn't end up getting penalized for that. Second time, it really seems like they got a slap on the wrist this season from contact with the GT car. Another one of those instances was at the Qatar race in the World Endurance Championship a couple of weeks ago. Thought they might get penalized for that late race contact with the Lexus over there. Similar story over here, a little bit of a different fashion. But once again, got away scot-free. I want to get some of your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I agree with you. I thought it was a slam dunk penalty. I thought the the Gradient Acura was very clearly on a very inside line. We didn't get the best camera angles from this, I will admit, but it did look like they were very clearly on the inside line intentionally. That seemed like it is the responsibility of the faster car to safely pass the slower classes. It is also, of course, very important that the slower classes help to facilitate that pass. But in this case, the slower class was trying to enter the pit lane. I don't know there's not really those hard rules that we see in IMSA the same way that there are in the WEC, I think. I think the WEC has some more strict rules on pit road entry lines.
You can't cross over the painted line on the track. If you do, it's some form of penalty. I don't know if it's a drive through or what, but you have to go over the painted line on the track, or you can't cross over that painted line. You have to be committed to the pits before that line starts.
Okay, so maybe I don't know if something like that, if more clear pit road entrance lines would help this, or again, it's difficult to say since we don't have a great angle of it. To me, looked like a slam dunk penalty, though. The Porsche just went to the inside and shot the 66 off into the wall hard. Unfortunately, you know, that ended the 66, the Gradient Racing's race, Catherine Legg's race, and team. They were on a great run. I think they were running fifth at the time as well. They seem to be having a pretty strong run in this race, and kind of, it was just one of those full course yellows that we got, of course, in the race.
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned, and this is where I'll get into my little side ramble, the sort of cautions breed cautions mentality of that race. We say it all the time in North American racing, whether it's Indy cars at ovals or especially NASCAR, it gets brought up a lot, but I think it definitely applied at this race as well. It seemed like there were a couple of occasions at least where we would have a yellow come out for a crash or some debris on the track, and then like two laps later, there would be another yellow for some other reason. Happened at the end of the race as well this year. Now, what I would like to see out of this is maybe some consideration for reform of how IMSA handles the yellows in their, at least in the endurance races. The sprint races, to be honest with you, you can do what you want. But I think with the endurance races, you mentioned this is the second year in a row we had 12 yellows at the 12 hours of Sebring. And I think somewhere before the race, I don't remember if it was you that said this or somebody had said, hopefully we don't see a repeat of what we saw last year with the number of yellows that we had. Lo and behold, we get exactly that. You know, I think we need to start bringing things like code 60s, virtual safety cars, into the conversation for some of those minor things like getting debris off the track. I think that should be more than sufficient. I don't really think we need to be having an entire full course yellow period where the cars are allowed to pass through the pit lane and it ends up being a 20-minute full course yellow just to clear some debris off the track that could have taken a minute. Now, of course, IMSA was taking advantage of the short yellows in the race. Yes. So if they had one yellow and then they had another one 2 minutes later, they would keep it short. It's like 2 to 3 laps.
No, and there were at least a couple of those.
Yes,
there were at
yes.
least a couple of those.
And I'll give them credit. It's a step in the right direction, but I still don't think it's necessary for us to have full course yellows, neutralized fields for simple things like debris on the track. And it's especially apparent at Sebring because, like I said, Sebring is rattling those cars to bits this year. We got a lot of new cars on track. And a lot of those cars are getting torn up because of it. And also, you know, Sebring is not the greatest track if you want clean racing at the end of the race. It's very much a very Rubens racing sort of circuit. so we had some of that contributing to the debris as well. I think the technology's there. I would like to see them at least evaluate trying to put a slow zone procedure in there. The other issue that I have, and this is probably the bigger one actually, is I'm a little bit frustrated over time with the way that these races are ending up at the finish, which is that we have a 12-hour endurance race at arguably one of the most physical tracks in the world, both for drivers and the cars. And for the second year in a row, it's coming down to a sub 20-minute sprint race at the end. We've had a couple of Sebrings in the last 6 years where there's been a less than 10 minutes on the final restart. And these cars, for the most part, I know I'm talking about parts flying off the cars, but the cars are pretty reliable nowadays. Way more reliable than what we would have seen decades ago. And so for the most part, attrition's not playing as much of a role as it used to with these endurance races. So it's really down to, if you're a driver and you're a team, you need to make as few mistakes as possible over the course of a 6 hour, 12 hour, 24 hour race. And unfortunately, for 5 of the last 6 years where we're getting a restart with less than 30 minutes to go, less than 25 minutes to go in the race, it's sort of turning into a arms out bashful sprint. And I do think that hurts not the integrity, but the quality of the endurance racing product a little bit. And I don't want to sit here and complain about the finish that we had. And I know that's sort of what it sounds like I'm doing. Everybody loves a good grandstand finish. And my heart was beating, I think it was up to like 120 beats per minute, watching Delatraz battling with Bourdais at the finish. But in the back of my head, there was just always that sort of, I wish it didn't come down to this. I wish that we had a little bit more of an endurance factor in this race. And I know I'm not the only one who's on that side of things, because we've had a couple of drivers complain about the driving standards at the end of the race. We'll get into that a little bit later as well. I think that when we get those sprints at the end, it sort of promotes that Rubens racing, bumping cars around mentality, that, I don't know, like I said, maybe hurts the quality of the endurance race itself. How would I solve that personally? What I would say is, in the final hour of the race, only for endurance races, again, do what you want with the sprints, but for the endurance races, whether it's 6 hour, 12 hour, 24 hour, or Petit Le Mans 10 hour, for the final hour, I would not separate the cars by class under the safety car. I understand that some safety car periods are going to be inevitable. You're going to have, you know, a big crash like we saw at Sebring. You're not going to solve that with a code 60. But I would like to see, for the final hour, let the cars have the traffic that they have to keep in mind. Let the cars that are ahead of the leaders, the respective class leaders in the safety car queue, wave around to the back of the field. And then you have a couple cars of us buffer. And I think if Bourdais was in a situation where he had a couple of GT cars, a couple of LMP2 cars in there at the end, you know, the 01 car, apart from the 31, was really the car to beat at Sebring this year. Just Cadillac looked especially strong the entire weekend. And I think that would have really gone a long way to helping them out at the end of the race. Whereas what we really got was Delatraz starting right behind Bourdais on that final restart, and a 12-hour race is sort of reduced to who has the best car and the best driver in the final 20 minutes, not the full 24, not the full 12 hours. A lot of rambling for me on that, but that's sort of where I stood with that race and the result that we got out of it. But I'm going to give you a chance to give your two cents on that as well.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, you mentioned virtual safety cars, code 60s, slow zones, you know, some sort of format like that. I think it's becoming more obvious that it is definitely needed. And, you know, to be fair, I don't think that would have greatly reduced the number of safety cars that we had. Maybe we reduce it by, I don't know, maybe three. Because there are still going to be instances where there's debris on track where, you know, it's not going to be possible to safely get a marshal there, even if they are going slow for these cars, is still pretty quick. And not in all portions of the track is it easy for a marshal to come, you know, come out and get the debris. So yeah, I think that, you know, that's a good start. I don't know how I feel about not separating the cars in the final hour. I wonder if that would create a little bit more, if that might lend itself to more chaos with, that you know, you get some prototypes that are aggressively trying to get back up because they know they're crunched for time. They have to try and make up time on the other cars in their class. If it might get a little bit more wild. But the thing that I like about what you said and like about that idea is that if you're the leader and you have six cars between you to your second place car, you know, you're not losing all of that. You know, you still right. have that slight advantage. You don't, maybe you don't have a 6 second advantage anymore, but you have a six car length advantage or, you know, there's six cars that the second place driver has to get past. So it's a fine line. It's a difficult one because I think if we knew how to solve it and we knew how to keep, this is something that really is a little bit more unique for IMSA compared to the WEC is I think it, a lot of it is because of the tracks that that are raced on in North America. But you don't want to completely kill certain aspects of it. Like, you know, this bunch them all up and have them go at it again. But you're right. The number of times that's happening over the course of a race is a little bit much and could be reduced. I guess, yeah, the ultimate question is how, and maybe it's a combination of things at the end of the day, but.
Yep. I mean, that's where I stand on it. And it's just my opinion. To be honest with you, in a perfect world, what I would like to see is a little bit of a hybrid of what we're seeing with the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship and the World Endurance Championship right now. I think that both of them go a little bit too far in their respective direction, where the WEC is way too, I guess, afraid to throw a safety car. Saw that very visibly at Qatar when there was a bunch of gravel laid down across the track. And for like 5 hours of the race, they just didn't touch it, never threw any full course yellow to remove it. At Sebring, I think we're throwing full course yellows too often. So finding a small middle ground in between those two, I think would be the nice happy medium that I would really like to see. But you know, it's what you're shooting for. If IMSA's goal right now is to generate some more of these grandstand finish highlight clips for YouTube, then that's fine. And it's, you know, that's the direction they want to take. But as an endurance racing product, and that's why I've been pretty strict about saying I only care about this for the endurance races.
Yep.
But as an endurance racing product, I think that the cars are reliable enough nowadays where I would like to see the overall performance of the team respected more than what we've seen in some races. And, you know, it's not just Sebring either. We've had championships become decided down to, you know, final sprints at the end of the race as well. We saw it last year with the contact between Pippo Durrani and the Acura of Wayne Taylor Racing.
Yep.
So we'll see if this continues to happen and there's continued instances where I guess the driver who deserved to win the race or the championship sort of got robbed out of that opportunity because of a late race yellow, maybe I'll become more vocal about it. But 5 years out of six for Sebring, where we're coming down to a 25-minute sprint shootout. That's the main takeaway I took out of this race.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think another big aspect of this too is maybe being, you know, it's kind of a byproduct of the increased number of cars on the grid.
Yes.
You know, if we're looking at this a handful of years ago, you know, we don't have half the number of cars on the grid, but you know, you could probably say that there are what, 20 fewer cars that were 20 fewer entries on the grid, like, you know, 58 to 38, maybe that's still a little bit low, but you know, reduced number of cars that were running around. There's obviously going to be fewer yellows as a result of that. I think even going from last year to this year, you know, you might hope that maybe getting rid of the LMP3s might help this a little bit. But you look at lots of the incidents that have happened this year, and it's pro driver incidents, that are bringing out a lot of these yellows that are non-debris yellows. Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be something to monitor because it will probably have to get addressed at some point. And another thing that I wanted to mention, and we'll talk about it more later, is just if driver standards are slipping, how can the officiating be modified to make it more of a penalty? I don't think this was in the WeatherTech race. I'm pretty sure this was in the Pilot Challenge race that I heard them talking about this. There was a car that got dumped. They got dumped. By the time they cut a tire, by the time they had made it all the way back around to the pits, you know, they had lost like two laps, and the penalty for the car, and they ended up having to retire from the race. The penalty for the car that caused the incident, it's like a drive-through penalty. And you know, the penalty doesn't fit the crime, right? You know, drive-through penalty, you're getting that back. If you start to implement more strict, more harsh penalties, I wonder if you start to see the driving standards cleaned up a little bit, but I don't know. We can talk about driving standards more in a minute.
Yeah, I think there's a bigger discussion we had there. You know, you talk about if we have cars that are, if we have the classes mixed up at the end of the race when we go for a restart, maybe that's going to cause more havoc than it fixes. And, you know, that's a concern that I had. I think that you definitely have a good point with that. But that sort of ties into the larger picture. Are we penalizing drivers enough for knocking other cars off the track? Are we being strict enough with the rule set there? Maybe there's some work to be done there as well. I am really glad that you brought up how many cars we had at the race. We had 57 cars. 20 more than what we're seeing in a WEC race. And you're right. We're not hitting record numbers of cars that we've seen at Sebring, but there are a lot more cars on a track that's not getting any larger. And it's definitely at least one of the contributing factors to why we're seeing as many yellows as we have. But again, I think there's still a little bit of improvement to be seen there. A couple of ways we could improve that. So ball's in Ipswich Park right now. I'll see what they want to do with it. Maybe they choose to do nothing, and we'll see if I have to make this same rant again after Petit Le Mans or Watkins Glen or Indy.
Definitely. But before we move on from some of this to other things, the number 30, when the number 31 crashed, and that was a huge accident. And I don't really want to talk about who's to blame there. I think it was a driving incident personally. Yep. The thing that concerned me the most was how the tires reacted.
You mean like the tire wall?
Yeah. How it exploded.
Yeah.
The first thing that came to mind is if a car hits it, I know it was a fairly fast portion of the track, but I don't think there should be an instance where we see tire walls explode like that.
Finish your sentence.
No, I was just going to say, I don't know what, because we haven't seen stuff like this happen before. I just don't know if they're like, you think back to Road Atlanta is an example that I always think of, because there's a lot of cars that go hard off in the S's portion. And the tires are and the tires are bundled really well together. And you see a car, and they, they virtually, in some instances, they go under that first row of tires that's, you know, 20 to 50 feet ahead of the final row of tires. They almost go under it and the whole tire bundle stays together. I don't know. It was just a little bit concerning to see the tire wall kind of explode like that. And especially with the tires going towards the fans. And we're lucky that there was no photographers that were right there either.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point with that. It is concerning. It's great that it didn't cause any incident this year. Some people are making the connection to Alan McNish's 2011 Le Mans crash where debris got thrown over there. Luckily, everything missed the photographers in that instance as well. Yeah. Brian Till and Calvin Fish over at on the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel, they did a nice little Sebring debrief. I think it was uploaded today as well, where they discussed that same incident, not really a car flipping over, but a car hitting that same tire wall happened in last year's Pilot Challenge race. Same exact thing. Tires went flying in that case as well. So sort of a repeat offense with the tires in that corner. And I'm not a track designer by any means, or nor do I have a PhD in physics. So I'm not going to propose my solution on how to fix that. You know, something they're going to have to probably investigate, because it's a scary situation whenever you have tires moving that close to a fan area. In fact, I think I saw a picture where some of the tires actually made it into the fan, like the zone where some of the fans can actually walk up to. You know, in that case, we're count our blessings that nothing bad really happened there.
Exactly. All right. I think we move on to a little bit of, well, more race weekend news. And I guess we're kind of stepping a bit backwards from race to qualifying, some qualifying notes. Some interesting stuff from qualifying tech. There were a number of cars that failed tech. The notables were all of the Corvettes failed tech. It was noted that they had some sort of unapproved parts on the car. I believe it was something tied to the splitters. I can't remember exactly what it was. I believe it was tied to the splitters. So all of the Corvettes ended up having to start at the back of their respective classes, customer and factory. And then also there was the Windward Racing Mercedes. They were notable because they set the fastest lap in the GTD class, but they were found with an illegal sensor on the car, and they had to go to the back of their respective class. Anything to say on these notes?
Not especially. You know, the notable one to me was Windward getting sent to the back of the GTD class after getting pole. Of course, they were able to make something good out of that, but we'll discuss that in a minute here. No, I wouldn't say I have a whole lot to add there. Just sort of an interesting tidbit that came out of qualifying. It's interesting that we had all four Corvettes fail qualifying to the same part, across two different teams as well. But that's pretty much the most I would say out of it.
Yeah. Got to get those. Got to make sure those are homologated parts. I was going to say homalgamated, which I have definitely said in the past. That's not it. In terms of the racing that we got to see during the race, there was a ton of good racing that we saw. You know, the GTD, the regular GTD class. I mean, was there a car in that, or at least a manufacturer in that class, that didn't see some time, you know, up in the top three over the course of the race? I really don't think there was. I can't think of one off the top of my head that wasn't strong at some point. You mentioned it was the Mercedes Windward Racing. They made something very good out of their race. They charged from the back of that class. They really looked to be the class of the class all weekend long. And ultimately it was Russell Ward, Philip Ellis, and Indy Donchi, I think I'm pronouncing that right, that take home the win. And with that, the 36 hours of Florida win as well. Any thoughts?
No trophy
on
for that though, huh?
No trophy for that.
No,
I mean,
for the 36 hours of Florida,
I guess bragging rights is pretty good. And having a nice healthy points lead is trophy enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what a better way to start the season than that. And of course, they weren't the only repeat winner to kick off the start of the season. We'll get to that in just a second here. Talking about GT, continuing with the GT classes, your pick, by the way, the 14 Vassar Sullivan Lexus, Jack Hawksworth, Ben Barnicot, and Kyle Kirkwood. You know, after we made those picks before practice, before any cars hit the track for that week, so really had no data to go off of, but very early on in the weekend, I was like, I should have picked Lexus there. I to be honest, I was going to pick them in GTD, because there's just something tugging at me saying Corvette would win in GTD Pro, but I was like, I should have picked the 12 Lexus for GTD. They're so quick here this weekend. Ended up being the right car to choose. Nice rebound from Daytona as well, where they had that unfortunate fire in the final stages of the race.
And it wasn't without controversy for the 14 either. They picked up a penalty for running over a crew member. It wasn't quite running over, but definitely was a bit of a scary moment. You're kind of holding your breath when you saw that unfolding. There was a lot of penalties that were handed out as a result of pit road, not necessarily incidents, shenanigans, perhaps we could call it, that went on in this race. But yeah, Vassar Sullivan, they whenever they got kicked, they just bounced right back and kicked back, as we'll talk about in a few minutes. Moving up one more class, of course, into the prototype classes. You know, it's hard to not say enough good things about the LMP2 class the last, I would say, couple of years. We've seen some great racing. This race was no different. You know, there were, again, it was a class where so many of these cars had time near the front, even the Sean Creech Ligier, which ended up finishing fourth in the race. You know, they ended up having a great run. Ultimately, at the end of it, it was the number 18 Era Motorsports entry of Connor Zilich, Ryan DeLeal, and Dwight Merriman that picked up the win. They had a good clash at the end with the 74. It was, I think, Felipe Fraga in the car there. I think Fraga ended up I don't know if he got together or if some earlier damage came back to bite him, but dropped off a little bit late. But yeah, yet another great race in LMP2. Connor Zilich, I guess he's not undefeated because he didn't win the MX5 Cup races, but you know, he has an undefeated IMSA WeatherTech record since he's been on the show with us. So I think we can take credit for his success, right?
Well, yeah, and an undefeated WeatherTech record in general. I texted him after the race, actually, and I said, you know what, you keep losing these MX5 Cup races by like photo finishes and you'll just keep winning a WeatherTech. And he said, it sounds like a deal. So that's the road that Connor Zilich is on right now. And another great performance from that team. Like you said, it wasn't without fault for that car. You know, they definitely had a couple of hairy moments in the race. But I think ultimately, we're talking earlier about how many safety cars were in the race. I think the safety cars brought them back into this one a little bit. At the finish, they had a very quick car. Zilch taking the driving duties at the end after Dwight Merriman put in the finish at Daytona.
It was Connor as well at Daytona.
No, it wasn't Zilch. I know that for a fact. It was at Daytona. I know it wasn't Zilch at Daytona. I thought it was Merriman. But it could have, yeah, I'm like 95% sure it's Merriman.
We can ramble and I'll check on it occasionally.
I'll take the GTP winner while you do that. GTP, I'll say one thing before the winner, though. We had all four, we had four of the five manufacturers up at the front throughout the race, with the only exception being, unfortunately, that of Lamborghini. Lamborghini, what can you say? They've had, you know, I'm actually going to say they had a good Sebring. They finished, I think, seventh in the race. But as my pick might have suggested, I didn't think they were going to run into any reliability issues in the race. And they really walked out of Sebring without anything too noteworthy, which is not necessarily a great thing, but also not a bad thing by any means. Didn't have any major dramas with the car, didn't send it into a wall. And left with, I think, their heads held high. they didn't have the cameras on them a whole lot, much like they did in Qatar. But I think that's a good baseline for the car. And for it to last the full 12 hours at Sebring, I think it might have surprised a lot of people. But good performance from them overall. In the end, like I said, all the other manufacturers spent some time leading the race, but it was the perhaps a little surprising win from the number 40 Wayne Taylor Racing with Andretti Global of Louis Delatraz, Jordan Taylor, and Colton Herta, solidifying the first victory for Wayne Taylor Racing with Andretti in the GTP era after a full season and two races. Talked about it for a while. I said, when's Wayne Taylor Racing going to get that win in the GTP category? And I've said numerous times now that Wayne Taylor Racing needs to capitalize more on some of the results earlier in the season if they want to have a great championship run. The number 40 car, two podiums in a row, got that podium third place finish at Daytona, backing it up with a win at Sebring. They are now tied with the number 7 Porsche at the top of the GTP leaderboard. Got to keep that consistency rolling, but I think that's a great start to the season for that Acura squad.
Yeah, really impressive, kind of final hour of the race, I would say, by Delatraz. You know, we've known for a while, well, at least last year, Delatraz showed that he was very, very quick. And, backing that up that and just showing that, you know, he was the right pick to bring in full time for that car. Definitely worthy of it. Really seems to be finding a really nice home in as one of the sort of the top sports car racers and the top racers in GTP. I think we're going to be talking about him for a long time to come. What more can you say about that battle at the end, though? As disappointing as it was that it was only maybe, you know, a 20 minute sprint in that final stint, we can't complain about the quality of racing that we saw, you know, between Delatraz and between Bourdais. It was tough racing, but it was fair and it was clean. And it was just, you couldn't ask for a better battle, I think, to finish that race out on. And even though I was rooting for the 0-1, full disclosure, at the end, it was, you can't come away complaining after that. So really good to see Wayne Taylor Racing break through with that win, kind of get that monkey off their back now in the GTP class. You mentioned Lamborghini, that they actually, you know, they were impressed. I was really impressed by Lamborghini. They got a lot of help from the full course yellows to be able to, you know, they gained a lap back at one point and just to help them stay on the lead lap. But if you looked at it, you know, once the run sort of settled in, especially in the first half of the race, they were just kind of minding the gap. Like they weren't getting, there wasn't, the other cars weren't running away from them. Yeah. We also saw Grosjean do a good job in that car to stay on the lead lap as long as he possibly could towards sort of the middle stints of that race. So I think Lamborghini had a pretty good showing and looking forward to see what they can do at the 6 hours of the Glen and, you know, maybe a shorter race and a track like Watkins Glen that's a little bit more smooth will play into that car quite nicely. To wrap up our thought on LMP2, that we were both wrong. It was Rasmussen in the car for the final stint of that race.
Okay.
Should have known.
Forgot the fourth driver. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Pretty good driver there.
Yeah. I'll take being wrong as long as we're both wrong.
That's true. Yeah. Speaking of being wrong though, should we quickly touch on our picks? For the race wins,
I'll explain my reasoning. I think I was pretty valid throughout most of it.
I mean, both of us picked Cadillacs to win in the GTP class. You picked the 0-1. I liked the 31. To be honest, I liked the 31 to repeat. Pipo Durrani, great storyline there. It was turning out. It was looking good, and then you know stuff happened. But what was your thought behind the 0-1 pick?
Well, to be honest with you, I just didn't want to pick the same car as you, but I wanted to pick a Cadillac.
Okay.
You know, and it looked like a pretty educated pick there.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. The 31 car was definitely the car to beat. I think if Durrani didn't have that accident, put him in the car at the finish, I think that they probably would have come out on top. Just had a little bit of a pace advantage over the 01 car. I think to Ronnie in the car at the finish would have been really the driver to beat as well. Like Sebring, he was going for his fifth victory in the 12 hours. I think that was a missed opportunity from them. But the 01 car came up a little bit short at the end. I think if they didn't have those couple of yellows at the end, that would have been the car that would have come out on top. In the LMP2 class, I picked TDS Racing. They were a strong runner throughout the race. Just didn't end up playing into their favor with some of the safety cars towards the end of the race, and ultimately didn't have that pace in the final stint to match what Connor Zilish was putting down. But Hunter McElroy, I will say, put in a great performance in that car as well. I think he was in the car during that turn 17 sort of three wide pass. Yep. that made some clips on Instagram. Great performance from them. I'm not really too ashamed to say they were my pick. But on the other side of things, you picked Tower Motorsports, and boy, they definitely could have had a better day.
Oh, yeah, Tower crashed in the tower turn. So, that's about all there is to say about that.
But you rebounded, though. You made up for it. I mentioned you picked the right car in GTD Pro. You picked the Vassar Sullivan 14 Lexus. I picked the number 4 Corvette. Corvette was a strong team at the 12 hours. The 3 car was really the car I should have picked. They were really in it at the end, but got pushed off at the very end of the race. A couple of times they got pushed off by the 4. Don't really want to say pushed off by the 14 Lexus in the hairpin, but definitely got rattled a little bit. And then ended up getting pushed off the track by the AO Racing Porsche ultimately in the final couple laps of the race. In GTD, I picked the Heart of Racing Aston. Looked like after we got some practice and qualifying times on the board that might have been the wrong pick, but they enjoyed some time towards the front of the class. I think they were in the top 4 a little bit. Don't know if they made their way onto or into the top 3. I will say with about 4. An hour left in the race,
they finished 4th.
Okay. I will say Magnus led a little bit of the race, especially towards the ending stages in the Aston as well. And it's great to see Magnus up front because it's not too often that we see them leading a GTD race, especially with the new Aston Martin Evo. But great to see them up at the front towards the end of the race.
On that Aston Martin Evo, that was, again, that was a brand new car for yep. Sebring. And, you know, it was the only we touched on Ford a little bit. We touched on some of the problems that Corvette had. They had another car that went like 2 laps. The AWA 17 officially did 2 laps in the race. So more problems there for Corvette. Aston Martin was really the only new car in the GT classes that didn't have issues. Yep. And I'll just touch on, I guess, my final pick here in GTD, the Inception Racing McLaren. Got together with Pfaff. We had a little bit of McLaren on McLaren violence go on there in turn one on the exit of turn one, I guess, to avoid a spinning Ferrari. Honestly, how that didn't cause a massive accident is truly incredible. But got together there. They rebounded pretty quickly. I think it was before the halfway mark in the race that they were back on the lead lap. They ultimately finished 7th in class. So maybe not quite the finish that they were looking for, but considering that they got together and had some issues very, very early on in the race, I think they will take that. Also notably here, there are only 2 cars amongst our picks that really didn't have any significant notable issues. The 01, your GTP pick, and then also the number 27, your GTD pick. Every other car had, you know, they got into big penalty trouble or had an accident. It was, yeah.
So I was on the right track. I'll take that.
Yeah.
Bonus picks. I said, got it half right, I guess. I said the Lamborghini SC63 would go the distance, finish in the top 5 in GTP. Didn't get the top 5. They did go the distance, like I had mentioned a couple minutes ago. And you had said, which was, I think, a really bold pick in itself, that every Porsche 963 would encounter some reliability issue in the race. And to be fair, The JDC had some issue.
Yes. It was drivetrain.
That was it. So
they had, I think it was like the right hand side drive shaft, something like that. They had some issue on the right hand rear of that car. I do think when I sent these to you, I also noted that there wouldn't be a Porsche that finishes in the top five. And that came very close to happening. The only Porsche that did finish in the top seven was the number seven entry. The other ones finished 8th, 9th, and 11th. So,
well, the Porsche streak is officially over. That's true. 2024 season that they had rolling. Didn't have that fairy tale ending at Sebring. I will say, you talked about how clean the driving was between Delatraz and Bourdais at the finish. There were a couple of moments where I thought, they're really going to probably wreck each other here.
Yes.
And who was sitting in third to pounce on that? It was nobody but the number seven car. And I was like, there's no way Porsche is going to steal this again, because these guys are going to wreck each other in the last 5 minutes. Kept it clean, though. And if you're a Porsche fan, that's probably one of the races of 2024 you'll want to forget. Just a couple comments here. Somebody in the chat earlier mentioned, and by the way, there's a lot of messages that we've been getting in the chat, so I'll try to get to as many of those at the end of the episode as I can. Thank you all so much for sending in those questions. Somebody asked, though, about the Louis Delatraz, or not Louis Delatraz, sorry, Danny Yoncadeo's comments about the driving standards. I think this was mentioned in the chat. This was also mentioned on X by SportsCarFan96. This is in regard to an article from Sports Car Racing 365. I will link it in the description after the show's over, and also in the description on podcasting platforms. Ultimately, he was driving the car in the final stint in the number three Corvette when they, well, I think, not a whole lot went great for them in the final stint. Like I said, they got pushed off by Jack Hawksworth. They got pushed off by the AO Racing Porsche. They had some run-ins with the Ricci Ferrari. Ultimately, the quote from Danny Yoncadeo, and I'm reading this from that article that I will link, is that the driving standards were shocking at the end of the race. And I think this really ties into what I was talking about earlier, this cautions breed cautions mentality, and perhaps we have too many, we're throwing safety cars too often, we're bunching up the field too often, we're restarting the race with a 20-minute sprint at Sebring. What do you expect is going to happen? Mm-hmm. It's pretty inevitable that somebody was going to be on the short end of the stick at that race, short end of the stick, and not have things go their way just because of the way that that race finished. And I think the number three car is really the one that took the ultimate hit there. So if we didn't get those comments from Yoncadeo, we were probably going to get them from somebody else ultimately. Simple way to fix that is be more strict with the penalties that you're assigning to these cars for contact. The AO Racing Porsche ultimately did get a drive-through at the end of the race, which I think was justified, sort of threw the race completely away for the number three car. They were just sort of sitting by the side of the track for the last four laps or so, and I was thinking they might throw a safety car for that. But ultimately they let them race. Like I said, easy fix to me. You just need to start being more strict with the driving standards penalties. And this is a discussion that we had after Petit Le Mans. It's a discussion that we're having again now. And if nothing changes, I'm sure it's going to be a discussion that we have again in the near future.
Yeah, it was. It was interesting to hear. Danny Hookaday's comments. I found it. I overall agree about the driving standards, of course, but I found it interesting that he called out Hawksworth, and specifically the Vasta Sullivan Lexus, because I didn't see anything that was atrocious that Hawksworth did. But this was Hawksworth's response to this. And you know, this is probably going to go on a t-shirt or something somewhere. But his quote was, "This is IMSA racing. It's hard fought. Rubbing is racing, right? This is what we do over here, and we came out on top." So interesting to hear, you know, almost, I don't know if he's calling out Danny and saying, you know, in IMSA, it is a more rough and tough the Rough and Tough series, you know, bumping and banging, beating and banging. I don't know. I just found it interesting, Hawksworth's comments there. And I wonder if that is some of the, I think it's pretty safe to say that Hawksworth is mainly an IMSA driver when it comes to sports car racing, you know, an IMSA driver. I wonder what the thought process is between some of these drivers that jump back between the WEC and IMSA. And then, because, you know, they probably are going into a race and have different thoughts on this than the drivers that are competing in IMSA on a regular basis. You look at like Pipo Durrani, you know, Jordan Taylor, not that Jordan Taylor's, you know, dirty or anything, or any of those drivers are dirty, but I just wonder how their mindsets vary on topics like this.
Well, it's a good point, because there were a lot of incidents in that race that went unpenalized, where if you tried to pull that in the WEC, you would have been sitting in the pit lane for a minute, stop and hold. And if that's what you're coming from, if you're coming from that European style of racing, then I can see where the frustration comes from. Again, that's for IMSA to decide how they want to regulate their own championship. Do they want to be more strict about those incidents, or do they want to encourage this physical style of racing? By the way, that quote from Hawksworth, that's an idea for your merch store. The only incident I saw, as I mentioned, between Hawksworth and Junkadea was that incident at the hairpin where Hawksworth really dove it in deep. He was very deep on the brakes at the end of that race, probably later on the brakes than any other driver, at least that we saw in the GT classes. But that's all that we saw. Whether something happened that didn't make its way to the TV screens, I'm not too sure. But, you know, and maybe it's just some compounded frustration from Junkadea that, you know, Hawksworth is dive bombing me, and then AO Racing sends me off track, and I have an issue with Daniel Serra and the Ricci Ferrari. You know, it could just be a case of some compounded frustration.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, because they were talking to Danny, you know, minutes after he had just been dumped and left to rot on the side of the road in the final three laps of when they were on for a podium at Sebring. So that very well could play into it as well.
Yep. Final notes from Sebring. I will say a couple of rumblings from the paddock. Had representatives from RFK Racing and Dale Coyne Racing walking around the paddock at the race. Whether they're out trying to scout for their next driver prospects, or maybe they're interested in either GT, LMP2, or GTP team, or maybe they're interested in the pilot challenge. We'll wait and see on that. Brad Keselowski did have a notable repost on X where he said that he would be interested in starting a GTP team or something along those lines, reposting a video of the Lamborghini GTP car. So maybe pure coincidence that we saw RFK representatives there days after Keselowski said that, or maybe not. And then also there was one Road to Indy team present in the paddock as well. Again, could be something small like scouting for drivers. Maybe they're interested in something like an LMP2 program as well. Wait and see on that.
Yeah, Brad Keselowski definitely throwing another couch into that that fiery rumor mill about potential manufacturer. Well, he didn't say anything explicitly, but, you know, he's pushing. Him pushing for an IMSA team is interesting. That's all I'll say.
Well, we're talking about IMSA teams. Let's talk about teams that will not be on the IMSA grid next year.
We don't know that for sure. We don't know that they're for sure not going to be on the IMSA grid.
I'll put my money down and say they won't be on the IMSA grid next year.
Okay,
well, I'll tell you one thing. They won't be on the grid with Cadillac Racing. That one was planned out again. Audio listeners, it's a Cadillac Racing shirt. A bit of a shock announcement, I'll say, although apparently to insiders in the sports car racing paddock, it wasn't so much of a surprise that Chip Ganassi Racing did not renew their contract with Cadillac and will not be racing their cars in either IMSA or the WEC next season. This news came out about a week ago, and it brought forward a lot of interesting questions right away. For instance, who's going to step up in IMSA? Who's going to step up in the World Endurance Championship, if anybody, to replace Cadillac? And it seems like we already have a couple prospects, especially with the Sebring weekend. That was one of the big talking points. Seems like everybody right now is saying that maybe we get a second Action Express Racing Cadillac on the grid in IMSA, potentially. You know, from some of the rumblings I've heard, maybe Meyer Shank Racing wants in on an alliance with that. Action Express Racing had that alliance with Hendrick with the 48 DPI car a couple of years ago. Maybe we see something similar from the likes of Meyer Shank. Shank already has a little bit of a tie-in there with Tom Blomqvist, driving in both the 31 car for the endurance races and also in the IndyCar Championship for Meyer Shank. I have heard that the discussions between Meyer Shank Racing and Alpine that were rumored have stalled out a little bit. We might not be seeing that partnership happen anymore, which would lead me to believe that if Meyer Shank Racing wanted back into IMSA, this might be the opportunity that they're looking for. For the World Endurance Championship, we have, I guess, a couple of parties interested. My first eyes go to TF Sport. Of course, they're running the two-car Corvette racing program in the WEC right now. Maybe we see them step up with one car. We see another team step up with another Cadillac in that championship as well. DailySportsCar.com did mention that they're expecting two Cadillacs on the WEC grid next year, which would be a step up from what we have this year. One of those rare cases, I guess, where you lose a team and it ends up being a net positive. Something that I'll be keeping my eyes on over the next couple of months. And then I guess the other question is, where does Ganassi go? Do they invest, or I guess divert, those IMSA sports car, IMSA and WEC resources over to their IndyCar program? Do they work on some alliance with a new manufacturer that is either in the series already or manufacturer that hasn't announced intentions to be on the series yet? Those are two other questions that got brought up in Sebring as well. Again, paddock rumblings that I heard, Ford's name got tossed around a little bit for, a reunion with Chip Ganassi Racing. I guess Ford is still evaluating a potential LMDH or hypercar program. Nothing formal yet though. So just something to keep in mind if Ganassi wants to switch their ways to another manufacturer on the sports car racing front. Also heard about the possibility, this has been discussed before, but the Peugeot 9X8 has been discussed in the past, rebranding to align with the North American manufacturer and then race in the IMSA championship. Previously, Dodge has been thrown around for the manufacturer for that. Hearing recently that Alfa Romeo could also be thrown into the pool for that as well, if something like that were to come to fruition. These are all very low-level rumors right now, though, so I wouldn't read into it too far. But at least things are being mentioned around the Sebring paddock, which is interesting nonetheless. Stu, I want to get some of your thoughts, though, on Chip Ganassi Racing's, like, a surprise exit from sports car racing.
Again. Yeah. Yeah, again. Unconfirmed. We don't know if they're, hopefully they're going to still be on the grid next year. I think we're all in agreement that we want to see Ganassi on the grid. Obviously have a very extensive history in IMSA or Grand Am, you know, dating back to the Daytona prototype. I don't know if it goes back even before that, but definitely back to the prototype days. Yep. Daytona prototype days. Definitely shocking. I know that Chip Ganassi, they haven't had the results that I think they want to have with the 0-1 in IMSA or in the WEC, although that car was pretty strong in the WEC last year. I think a lot of people would agree with that. But
first half of the season.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Ganassi, it's a bit surprising. It kind of makes you wonder. All indications are that it kind of seems like it was a bit of a mutual thing. Nobody seemed at least yet, nobody seems super salty about the partnership ending. I think you hit you mentioned the obvious rumor here, and the way that it seems like Cadillac is leaning with their replacement, Action Express Racing, and their efforts there. Yeah, I think that makes sense. It would be interesting to see if maybe Action Express links up with Hendrick, maybe, and sort of that rekindles that relationship, or what might happen there. But yeah, I think that's the most likely route right now. But did you mention at all the WEC prospects?
Yes, I did. Well, at least with TF Sport would be the first name I would throw out there.
Yeah, they're running the Corvettes, I believe. Yeah. So that existing relationship there would be nice to see. And then, of course, anytime you talk about adding an additional hypercar or LMDH to the grid in the form of the Peugeot, whether it's as Alfa Romeo or whatever badge it comes over. Yeah, the Dodge Ram 1500. I was thinking the Bronco, but that's Ford. So maybe Ford. Maybe we can have Bronco. A Bronco versus 15. Versus Ram 1500.
And then Chevy can just give us a rebadge Cadillac as a Silverado, and Toyota
or an Escalade.
Give us an Escalade. Give us a Toyota Tundra GR. You know.
There we go. We're
a truck racing series now.
GT trucks. Now I think any manufacturer that comes is going to be great. I mean, the question is where do they slot in on the grid? We're going to talk about this in a moment, but with IMSA releasing the schedule so early and teams being able to plan out their season so much farther in advance and get everything locked down, sponsorship, drivers, everything that goes with that, it makes you wonder, like, it's going to become more and more and more difficult to try and get an entry on the grid. And
yeah.
How are we going to determine who gets on the grid in the future? Like, is it going to go to some of the new, are we going to lean towards the top class with GTP and invite these new manufacturers in, or are you going to give teams, you know, that have shown loyalty to the series that bump? Remains to be seen.
Yeah. And I'll ask you one thing. Do you like puzzles?
I guess it depends on the puzzle and how many pieces are in the puzzle.
All right. Well, there's only two pieces to this puzzle. It's a rather easy one. You know, we're talking 10 minutes ago about some of the teams that were in the paddock. RFK Racing is the one I want to talk about here. If they're interested in a GTP program, well, there might just be an opening for that in IMSA right now if they want to jump in 50-50 with Action Express Racing. I know they're a Ford team in NASCAR, and... You know, we'll see if Ford wants to jump in 2 feet with with a sports car racing program. Actually, they already have a sports car racing program with GT3, but a hypercar LMDH program. Maybe they would align themselves with that. But for now, maybe the opportunity is just waiting for them to partner up and race at IMSA. We'll wait and see on that one. That's just one that popped in my head. You mentioned the 2025 IMSA schedule, and I'm going to keep this brief because there's really not any changes to the 2024 schedule. You made a whole video about this, worth a watch if you haven't seen it yet. But I think that what we're seeing from IMSA here is just exercising a lot of caution. Okay, they've got really a great championship right now with a huge number of cars on the grid. We're seeing pretty much capacity grids at every single event on the calendar for the most part. And I guess the last thing you want to try to throw into that is an unknown variable that might interrupt that consistency that you have right now. I personally would have loved to see a dual header with the WEC again at a track like COTA. The COTA weekend right now is set up where IMSA could run on a Saturday, WEC could run on Sunday. And it's just a little bit unfortunate that we're not seeing that sort of reunion between the two championships at an event after the loss of Super Sebring this year. But nonetheless, it's a championship that we have for this season. I wouldn't say there's necessarily, actually I lie. There are a couple of negatives that I pull out of it, because it, with it being a copy of this season's schedule, we still don't have GTP cars at your home race at Canadian Tire Motorsports Park. Yep. We don't have any cars at my home race at Lime Rock Park. You know, it's a very conservative schedule in sort of the worst way possible, but for consistency and keeping the teams and manufacturers happy might have been the smart move on their part.
You know what? Even though it is, like you said, a pretty conservative schedule, and you know, it's essentially exactly the same as what we're going to see play out this year. If this helps us to avoid some of the conflicts that we've seen with many other big races, whether it be the World Endurance Championship, whether it be some of the big SRO races, I'm all for it. Luckily they got some of the conflicts taken care of, but there's still clashes with the WEC and IMSA races, which is not really, nobody wants that. Neither series wants to have that. So hopefully, you know, IMSA won the race, if you want to say that, in getting the schedule out, and hopefully the end result is that they're able to avoid some of these conflicts. But yeah, like you hit the hammer on the head, you know, no Lime Rock back on the schedule. Maybe we'll see something there with sort of a support series extravaganza. You know, maybe you can get four or five support series that goes out there, although I don't know if the paddock you would know better than I would if the paddock is large enough to support. The support series, definitely not small grids either. We saw record class sizes among lots of the sports series this weekend. So I don't know if that would be possible looking at next year, but yeah, no Lime Rock, no GTP at CTMP. And those are two sort of L's, not ideal, thumbs downs on the schedule. So yeah, but you know, good to have it out early, I guess.
Yeah, that's the best thing they could have done, is just got that schedule out when they did. It usually comes out around August.
So yeah, 5 months early.
And I think that schedule drop came as a surprise to everybody. I knew that something was going to be announced on, what was that, Friday morning when they announced that. But schedule announcement was sort of the last thing on my mind. I thought something along the lines of like a series partnership announcement or something like that. But no, nothing we got on that front. I will say, since we forgot to mention it, the IMSA tried out a new thing this weekend by streaming the race on YouTube for the first time, 12 Hours of Sebring. And I will say, really smart thing on their behalf, I think. This is something that, if you're going to stream the race for free anyways, I think YouTube's a great platform to do it. IMSA TV has been no stranger to having some issues in the past, especially at the Rolex 24, with just too much traffic on the site and it bringing the stream down and people can't watch, and it causes a lot of frustration. Throw it on a reliable platform like YouTube. The most I saw was like 22,000 current viewers on the stream on Saturday. Might have peaked a little bit higher than that. And that's all without being available in the United States, unless you have a VPN. You know, so for most people, I think that that's a great way to watch the series. And if nothing else, it's getting you, and it's bringing you straight to the IMSA YouTube channel. And they're putting out some great content there as well. You can catch yourself up on some Win the Weekend episodes while you're there. Just started out a new season of that as well. You know, I just think that's the place to be if you're going to be doing this for free. Now, they haven't announced yet if that's going to be a sort of the new normal for them, if that's something they plan on doing for the remainder of the season. They sort of described it as a trial or just an experimental run. But hopefully, my fingers are crossed that they stick down that route for the remaining races on the calendar. And you know, while you're at it, throw qualifying on there as well. Throw the pilot challenge race.
They did actually put the Super Trofeo race on there as well. On the second one on Friday was on there. So, yeah, as a legitimate international viewer, I can say that that I thoroughly enjoyed being able to watch on YouTube. And as someone that doesn't use an ad blocker, I think it pushed me to want to get YouTube Premium. So,
yeah. Where, how are they doing with the mid-roll ads on that? Were they scattering the mid-roll ads throughout?
I think they just let YouTube do its thing, and YouTube bombarded me with ads in the final couple minutes. As soon as Delatraz was crossing the line,
I was gonna say,
it pops up an ad. I'm like, you kidding?
Well, then maybe
me?
That's something you work on, Imsa. Maybe you manually place the ads, you know. Full course yellow ads.
Yeah.
Not when Delatraz is passing for day.
That's true. That's true.
As somebody in the United States, I quite enjoyed my trek to the Canadian border over some of the NBC commercial breaks.
Yeah, your computer had a nice trip.
It did, yeah. You know, I just walked there. It's not that far away. So I wanted to get to some of the comments and questions that we had in the chat from this episode. Like I said, there was a lot of them, so I'm going to try my best to get to as many of those as possible. Got a comment earlier on saying, hey, it's Tyler from the Way Into the Racing Andretti number 45. I thought the race was pretty fun and really, really hot. Yes, it was a very hot Sebring. And that's one of the things that I don't miss from my couple of times going there in person is the heat and humidity that comes out of a race that is that close to the Everglades. A great run for the sister car and that program. And we actually spoke to one of your drivers, Danny Formel, before the Rolex 24. So appreciate you tuning in.
I met Tyler at the Rolex. Certified good guy.
Okay. Certified there good you go. Guy. On your word, I'll take it. let's be fair, the LMP2 cars are the new LMP3 with all the yellows and spins. You know, and that's something that people were a little bit afraid of at the beginning of the season is, okay, wait a minute. We have a lot of drivers in the LMP3 class that, let's just say, are not as experienced. And we're going to put them into cars with more downforce and more power. And we're going to see how that works out. And, you know, you're right that we're seeing some of those incidents just sort of migrate to the LMP2 class. But I don't think LMP2 has become the full-blown sort of meme yet that LMP3 had the honor of taking.
Yeah, I think it was concerning at the Rolex the way that at times that class was appearing out there. But Sebring, we saw two cars in the LMP2 field not finish. It was the 88, the Richard Mille, that car, which was that caused one of the full course yellows. I think Lila Wadu was in the car, and I don't know what the heck happened. It's the way that she got out, it seemed like the car was on fire. But we never really got clarification on what happened there. And then there was, of course, my pick for LMP2 win, Tower Motorsports. They retired. We also saw Spike have a hard off into the wall. But overall, I think LMP2 did a pretty good job of behaving themselves in this one. Certainly better than the Rolex, I thought. But
yeah. Yep. We were talking earlier about the tire barriers at Sebring and sort of getting thrown over the fence when Pipo Derani had his accident. Gam Wolfers in the chat said, should they replace the tire wall in the section and any high speed corners with a safer barrier or a Tech Pro? Depends how much money Sebring has. Sebring is an NASCAR-owned track, though, so they should have the backing behind that. I think Tech Pro barriers would probably make a little bit more sense there, and they definitely wouldn't get thrown about as much as we saw there. But as you mentioned, we do see some tire walls at Petit Le Mans as well, and they don't go thrown around. They're not thrown around.
They don't explode
like we saw at Sebring. So maybe there's something they can modify there and keep it on the cheaper side without sending more tires into the fan areas. Safer barrier, I don't think is really necessary at Sebring, apart from maybe turn 17, you could possibly make an argument for it.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I mean, only safer barriers I've seen in sports car racing I guess dedicated sports car racing tracks were Daytona, obviously, and Le Mans actually has some now as well in the Porsche curves.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you can go ahead. I'm just reading through the chat.
Oh, I was going to say about turn 17, that might be a good spot at Sebring for it, because you saw how Catherine Legg, her car, when she went into the tires, it bounced her. She bounced right back out into the middle of the track, which is, you know, that could be a very scary moment. You already have a compromised car that gets thrown back out right onto essentially the racing line. We saw actually in that moment, we saw a sympathy spin from an LMP2 avoiding that. So, but that could be a good spot for safer barriers. Right.
Yep. Yeah. Spalding Media Network. Hey guys, good to see you. Good to see you as well. How about ERA? In all the pressers, the addition of Zilich has really united that team. Just a different vibe. How different will ERA be once they hit the non-endurance races? You know, they're starting off the season on the right foot. They had a great driver lineup. They seem like they have a very confident driver lineup, like you mentioned with Zilich right there. I definitely sort of get that same vibe that the team and the drivers are really getting together really well. We're not going to see the LMP2 class until Watkins Glen in June. We got a long time before we see those cars on track again. And that's also another one of the endurance races that Zilch will be present at as well. But I'll be keeping my eye on that team even beyond there, just to see how they can keep up that performance. But one of the early championship favorites early on.
Yeah, they've been in IMSA for maybe a handful of years now. They haven't... they've spent a few years here, won some of the big races. I can't remember if this, you know, the Ryan DeLille and Dwight Merriman combo has been together and been a consistent for all the years that they've been here in IMSA. But, you know, maybe we're seeing some of that familiarity as well. Maybe they can carry that and just knowledge of these tracks and the car. Perhaps they can carry that over and translate it to some more results over the course of the season in these non-endurance races.
Yep. Somebody said, so that's Daytona with a little asterisk next to it. Sebring and Petit, big endurance victory for the ARX06. They really need to be in the World Endurance Championship. Nothing left to prove or evaluate, as they keep saying. That's just always one of the big, we'll wait and see things, is will Honda Global give the green light to bring that car over to Le Mans? I think Andretti would definitely be interested in it. If I'm not mistaken, Wayne Taylor Racing switched over to Acura for the hope of going to race in Le Mans. how ironic is that now that Cadillac's over there and they're not? So my fingers are crossed that we'll see them at least in Le Mans in maybe 2025. World Endurance Championship as a whole might be a little bit less likely, but like I said, fingers crossed for that one. A couple of people are just commenting on the number of full course yellows at Sebring. A couple of people agreeing that the number of full course yellows that we're seeing at Sebring got a little bit frustrating, and maybe some of the repeat yellows that we saw right after the race had gone green again. Yeah, right here. Somebody, the irony of Wayne Taylor Racing switching to Acura because of Le Mans ambitions. Exactly what I had just said.
Spalding Media Network saying this race is getting him, Connor Zilich, ready for his COTA run this weekend. Oh, no, that's talking about Jack Hawksworth, who's also racing in the truck race at COTA. So, you know, we might not see IMSA on track for like another month, but you can see some IMSA drivers on track at COTA in the truck series. I think it's this Friday.
Yep. All right. I did a quick scan through to see if there were any questions that I had missed. I didn't see any, but if I did miss any, feel free to yell at me, and I'll try to get to them next episode. I think that's good enough for a wrap, though, in this episode. Stu, I want to see if you have any closing thoughts, though. We're coming off of Sebring. We have a long time now, unfortunately, until the next IMSA and WEC race. It's almost like we're jumping back into the offseason a little bit here. Maybe we'll get some exciting news stories between now and then.
Yeah, maybe we will. Maybe we'll get some more clarity on the direction that Cadillac's going to be leaning. I think overall, though, you know, you look back at Sebring and, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be, I think that final stint, I said it before, even though it was short, I think it did produce some incredible racing. You know, we saw a great sprint to the finish with Bourdais and Delatraz. It seems like the Cadillac, you know, they've been strong in both of the IMSA races so far this year. You know, can they keep that going at Long Beach where they didn't really show up at all last year? You know, the 31 had weird strategy. And then of course the 01 had that spin heading in on the first lap into turn one. So can Cadillac bounce back from some of their, you know, poor results at Long Beach last year and carry forward this early season momentum this year? Again, Porsche is probably going to be strong. Actually, one of the things that we didn't talk about at Sebring, and I just want to touch on quickly, was BMW. Sure. I think BMW, from my point of view, I thought that they took a nice step forward in this race. They found themselves at the front. Maybe, I don't know if they really led for a significant amount of time or at all, but
they lead.
Okay. They certainly were much more competitive. They ended up finishing fourth and sixth, but they definitely had some quite strong runs over the course of the race, and I think that bodes well for them looking ahead to the rest of the season.
Yeah, well, I was talking earlier in the episode about Wayne Taylor Racing and Andretti finally getting that first victory under their belt for the GTP era. BMW, I have to imagine they're not far away from getting their first win without technicality in the GTP class. They have that win at Watkins Glen last year because of the Porsche penalty. But, you know, you have to imagine that they're pretty close nowadays.
They were strong at Long Beach last year.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to see what they're going to be like at Long Beach in a couple of weeks. Alex Achilles in the chat said, predictions for Long Beach. I'm excited because I'll be there. Well, first of all, should really enjoy that event. You get, not only do you get IMSA, if you're there for the whole weekend, at least you get IMSA, IndyCar, Formula Drift, jumping trucks. I'm forgetting, like, historic cars, go out and do some demo runs there as well.
Yep.
So really hope you enjoy that weekend, especially if it's your first sports car race. But if it's not, you still should have a great time there with the sheer talent and diversity that we have on the IMSA grid this season. Completely dodge your question there. I will be putting out some Sebring prediction posts as we get closer to the race. I would like to try to keep doing the prediction posts so we can see how wrong Stu and I are going to be throughout the season. So keep your eyes peeled. See what we jinx. Keep your eyes peeled for that. Throughout the season, we'll be keeping tabs on IMSA and the WEC predictions as we get closer to the races themselves. So I think that's enough of an episode. We're coming up to the trademarked hour and a half point of the episode. And I think that's good enough to call this one a wrap. Thank you all so much for tuning in to this episode of the Rain Race Podcast. Hope to see you in 2 weeks. Hopefully we'll have a lot of news to discuss then, because like I said, no races in the near pipeline. We got to wait a little bit over a month or so for that. Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you have a great night whenever you're listening to this. Take care.